Since 1898, Marquee Who's Who has offered our distinguished listees the opportunity to set themselves apart through our print publications. Now, Marquee Radio offers these illustrious professionals the chance to shine in our one-on-one interviews. My guest today is Dr. James Bordenwalt, who is Professor Emeritus of Arizona State University. How are you doing today, James?
Just fine, thank you.
Glad to hear it. So why don't you start by telling us what field of study you're involved in and what led to you deciding to make teaching your career?
My interest is, or has been, microelectronics, computer chips. I was one of the premier workers in that. In fact, one of the things that's not been listed in some of the other things about my work in the microelectronics is that I was editor of the first book on computer chips, called the book Integrated Circuits Design Principles and Fabrication, publicated by McGraw-Hill, and it was supported by, while I was at Motorola. And it was the first book on how to make computer chips.
Mm-hmm. So and, what interested you particularly about computer chips?
It was one of these things that I was interested in electronics and chemistry. And most people think of the computer chips as being strictly electronic. But the real truth is that once the computer chip is designed, since the design is committed to paper, everything from there on in up until it gets tested electrically is all chemical processing.
That's certainly very interesting. And I mean, I'm a layman when it comes to that sort of thing. If you show me a computer chip, I'll think it looks very pretty, but I really wouldn't have any in-depth understanding into how it works. Can you maybe give us the broad strokes of what's involved behind that wafer?
Well, of course, the active part of the what's on the wafer, what's on the in the chip, are transistors. And right now, all of the technology is all based on what are called MOS, metal oxide silicon semiconductors, transistors. And the whole thing is that through chemical and thermal processes, and photo engraving is another major part of it, to get the shape, size, and placement of all the components, and then to use thermal and chemical processes to embed the device into the silicon wafer, and then finally, to put a coating of metal over it, usually aluminum, but not exclusively aluminum, and then that is by photo etching brought down to being just like a micro miniature circuit, electronic circuit board that connects up all of the transistors on the chip so that they work together to do the function that it was designed to do.
And as these transistors, as these chips effectively become smaller and smaller due to advances in technology, is that because we're essentially following the same steps, it's just that the components are getting smaller, or is it an entirely different way that the chip is designed and built?
By and large, it's just simply taking the things and shrinking it, using advanced photomicrolithography to make the individual components smaller and smaller. The early stages, when I wrote the book back in 1963-64, we considered a very, very small thing to be 2 microns in component to be 2 micron diameter. We use all metric, by the way, just for a reference. Average human hair is about 100 microns in diameter. Human blood cells about 6 to 8 microns in diameter. And we were doing then about 2 micron space lines and spaces in the chips. Now, they have using continual advancement in the photolithographic process, have reduced the size down to 2 nanometers. A nanometer is about 1/10,000th of a micrometer, so that gives some sort of an idea. It's greatly reducing the size of each component and therefore making it possible to put more and more and more components on the same size chip of silicon.
Do you think there's a limit to how small we can take this? I mean, you're talking about nanometers. Is there a possibility we could go down to picometers or femtometers? Like, do you see there being a floor to this kind of technology or a ceiling, depending on how you look at it?
I guess the floor is probably a better way to put it. We're getting down to the point of where the limit is going to be the spacing between the silicon atoms in the single crystal silicon that the chips are made of. And we're getting pretty close to that right now. So I really wonder what way we may have to go beyond the density number of transistors in a single chip than we have right now. But we're certainly getting a lot. I have read, I have no idea what this chip will do or who it was made for. You can make your own guess, where they have put 1.5 trillion, that's trillion with a T, transistors on a single chip.
Wow.
Yeah. But when you stop and think, now I'm sitting here looking at a nice little Apple telephone, handheld thing, has probably 80 billion transistors in it. It's a macro computer just in itself, but it's only about 1.5 inches by 5 inches. It's a telephone, and it does all kinds of other things, and they're everywhere. Everybody, I mean, you see 5-year-olds playing with them like this. This one is really kind of an old one, and it's not very sophisticated. We estimate about 80 billion transistors in it. So, you know, we're going to just see more and more interesting things as it develops.
Oh, I'll bet. What does that mean for processing power then?
Well, processing power, the people that are working in the fabs now or in the research areas attached to the fabs are working on developing better and better ways of doing it. One of the things they're talking about, although I don't think it's anywhere near ready for manufacturing, is to go 3D on it, where we do a layer with transistors like we're doing right now, and then do another layer by some sort of deposition process over it of more active devices, and then being able to double the number of transistors and therefore double the power of the chip. But as far as I know right now, that's still back lab stuff.
So rather than increase the length, they would increase the thickness?
That's one of the ways they could be going.
Okay. That makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me like you guys are researching sort of the bleeding edge of technology here, where we're taking these massive leaps forward. Did your research ever take you into just researching these new and innovative techniques?
Well, I was mostly involved in working with just whatever was going on that was a cutting edge, yes. So worked on – remember, I have been retired now for about 20 years, so I
am sure.
Looking – what I'm doing is reporting on is just what I read and hear scuttlebutt from people. So a lot of what's going on, we don't talk about outside of the lab. So there's probably things going on that I don't know about that could just keep this increasing the power, if you will, of the devices. With time can go on for, you know, I don't know how long. I don't know. I used to feel like there was a stopping place, a place that we, you know, would be the wall we couldn't pass or go over. And every time we've hit one, just gone right by it. So that's kind of where I'm at right now as far as my thought that I don't know how what the next direction will be, but I will not be surprised when I hear about it when that somebody has done it. That making a chip with 1.5 trillion transistors on it boggles my mind.
And yeah, mine as well.
You know, what will they do with it? It's got to be for some very that exceeds just on a chip what more than a lot of computers. You know, the major computers, not our home computers, but major computers actually involved with. So, you know, where is the end? I don't know.
Would heat displacement be a concern with that many transistors?
That's a good question. Heat, by and large, the heat dissipation is not too bad. Most chips are fairly easily cooled. I mean, look at the 80 billion of the ones that this little toy I'm talking to you through is, and it's not even warm.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing an awful lot of processing, and I just ran my fingers on it. It feels room temperature. So my first reaction is probably not.
Okay. All right. So we've painted a pretty comprehensive picture of, you know, what the field entails, where the future of it is. But let's talk more about you and your contribution. So what have been the projects that you've researched? What's interested you the most while you were involved in active research and active education?
Well, my first contribution where I really, you know, the one thing that set me out was the book, Integrated Circuit Design Principles and Fabrication, the Motorola book, the technology that I was a lead engineer, I was the project manager at Motorola for the computer chip project. This is back in 1962. And we were dying on the vine. Nobody was interested in buying the things. The second quarter of 1962, our total loss was $400 less than the combined materials, labor, and overhead. That meant we sold $400 worth of computer chips that quarter. And since we're selling them at that time for about $50 a pop, that meant we sold about 8 of them. And, it just looked like the whole computer chip idea was going to die. And our general manager, Vice President Motorola, Vice President said, we've got to do something about this. This is the future of electronics. He knew. He really had the foresight. And so he said, what we need is a textbook because they're not teaching microelectronics at all in the universities. They're still teaching vacuum tubes. And if we had a book that explained how these microchips worked, they might that would probably solve the problem. So he decided and went to McGraw-Hill and proposed textbook for this. And the president of McGraw-Hill practically fell off of his chair laughing. He said, you expect me to publish a book about something and sell a book that you can't even, about a product you can't even sell? I can't afford to do that. And so Dr. Hogan said, what is your basic cost? What would I have to cover for you to be willing to take on it? And he said, probably $5,000 would get me. So So Dr. Hogan said, okay. And the rest is history. McGraw-Hill published the book. First publication was 10,000 copies. And then we thought that would be all. But instead, it ran through 10 printings each. All but the last printing was were 10,000. The last printing was 100,000. And that was, it actually came out in 1964. And, you know, the last time I looked on Amazon, they still have used copies of the book. And my son, I'm here in Boise, my son was in looking through a local used bookstore and ran across one, bought a copy. It turns out I looked inside, it's out of the seventh printing, and they're still bringing about $4 a copy used, now 50 years old. So the book really, really had an impact on the integrated circuit. It was after that, the whole thing just took off.
I see. So I assume your sales numbers went up then, among other things.
Oh, went out of the roof.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm sure I don't need to remind the audience that obviously microchips, the use of microchips eventually took off. I mean, it was.
Yeah, that was when they really literally got launched, is when we got the books out there, and the electrical and electronic engineers knew what a computer, what these chips would do. They switched over to them from vacuum tubes and discrete single transistors, and that was just kind of the major turning point. Now, I look upon that as being the pivot from conventional vacuum tube and discrete transistors to the computer chip or integrated circuit.
Okay.
Domination.
So take us through this. You publish this book with help from McGraw-Hill, and it changes the game in terms of microchips, and now they're being adopted more and more widely. You're a researcher at the forefront of this. What is your role in aiding companies' implementation of this, in driving the technology forward? What is your role at the front of such a burgeoning industry?
Well, I worked for Motorola in that for number of years till I finally got more requests or job offers than I could refuse, and I changed then to the American Microsystems. I was the associate director of research there, and then I went on and decided that really at that point what we needed were things to be taught in school. So that's when I left the industry and went into teaching, and I had all the friends at Motorola still to help me set up a little toy lab. I mean, a complete chip fabrication at the University of Arizona, so that I could take a group of students through in a semester and have them go through every step of making a microcircuit, computer chip. They all would get the working computer chips at the end of the semester. And then Arizona State University got even bigger. And, of course, all of the companies in the Phoenix area wanted more help. So I moved on up to Arizona State and repeated the operation that and taught so that my contribution at that point was producing engineers, graduate engineers, because this was a senior level, graduate level course that I taught, and I taught that course until I retired. Then I did consulting. I should say I did not drop out of things. I consulted for about 5 years after that.
So you've really been involved in all aspects of, if I can simplify the concept of a microchip to a single product, you've been involved basically in every aspect of that product's life cycle, because you were involved in developing the technology, you promoted the technology to make it more widely adopted and understood, and you also produced the professionals, the engineers, that would be working with the product day in and day out. So you're really the man behind the curtain, as it were, regarding microchip technology. I think that's very impressive.
I think that very succinctly puts it. That's the way I visualize myself, that I was the one behind pushing the whole concept, because the microchip is the basic concept of just a microchip is so flexible that the electrical engineer has something he wants it to do, and he can sit down and go through the just design phase, and then once he has it designed, has how the transistors are connected on the chip, from then on, it's my processes.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think has been the greatest, most satisfying part of your work?
Just watching the whole thing grow. I mean, from being something that we couldn't even hardly give away in the early 60s to something that now I just read about a thing in the Wall Street Journal the last day or so about the fact that China now has more fabs making the computer chips, making microchips, than the United States does. And of course, that hurts me. I really feel bad about that. But they doing it. Taiwan's got a lot. And finally now, people like Intel and some of the others are building new fabs. I just read where they are getting two new fabs in the Phoenix area just to respond to the increased need, because they're so fundamental to so many things. I mean, like, for example, one of the problems that evidently Detroit is having building cars is now they have got so many computer-controlled parts of the car, components that their computer control that used to be mechanical linkages and things like that, that it's holding up the manufacture of cars. And just for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're just kind of, I would say, endemic to almost everything around now. From that personal computer you sit down in front of and play solitaire with, to the TV set, to your car, to the airplanes. The commercial airliners depend heavily on the electronics in the cockpit that help guide the airplane, help control all of the engine control, and control some of the aerodynamic controls, flaps and things like that.
That's true. Your work really does touch every aspect of our lives now.
That's right. The computer chip, if all of a sudden computer chips just folded, I don't know what I'd be afraid we might starve to death.
Well, possibly. Hopefully it doesn't come to that.
No, what I'm alluding to, if all of a sudden somebody pulled a magic wand and said, you know, no longer will electrons behave the way they do, so all of the computer chips stopped working instantaneously, we'd be in great big hurt.
So, James, at this point, I'd like to ask you a question that I ask all of my interviewees. When you look back on your life as a whole and your career as a whole, what do you think has been the most important lesson that you've learned?
Oh, boy. Stick to what you're doing. Think about it. Make sure that what you're doing is the right thing, and then stay with it.
And I think that's good advice. Thank you, James, for taking the time out of your day to share your story with our listeners. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to Marquee Radio. Stay tuned for more in-depth and informative interviews with professionals from all walks of life.